You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Justin Jackson, good to have you, buddy.
Brad D'Antonio, man. It's funny. Like, I listen to your podcast and I play it at 1.5 speed. So I'm used to hearing the cadence of your voice, like moving at that speed. So now it's going to be slowed down. So I think I'm going to get in the zone here.
Great. So I sound slow. You've listened to it at 5X?
1.5.
Oh, okay. Now that's not so bad. I've thought about that. I talk faster now than I did when I first started the podcast, I've noticed, but I've had people tell me they listen to 1.5X. So then I'm not bothered to try to slow down, knowing that they're going to manipulate the levels anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're in Okinawa, correct?
I am in Okinawa, Japan. Yeah.
What are you doing there?
It's a funny story. So I am out here on what is called a Title 10 involuntary mobilization. So I serve in the Marine Corps Reserves, got out of active duty in 2014, been a reservist ever since. And my unit was tasked with a involuntary mobilization. So one of us had to go. And a lot of things that were going on back home at the time. I had just sold my house in Montana, moved down to Asheville, North Carolina. We got knocked out of Asheville by Hurricane Helene, and then we went down to Greenville, South Carolina. So we didn't have a home. I was still trying to start my business. It was going kind of slow. So when this involuntary mobilization came up, they actually selected a different pilot in the squadron. And I was pretty familiar with his background and kind of family situation. And let's just say he had a lot less flexibility than I did. And so I talked about it with the wife and I said, look, this is going to be a year-long thing. You guys can come out here with me. I'll fly you out, get you an Airbnb, and give you a chance to travel and, you know, see a new place in the world, bring the boys and show them something cool. And yeah, so I volunteered for that and have been out here since February of this year, and I'll go back home in November. So Okinawa.
And that's about midway between Japan, like the mainland, and Taiwan. Is there a reason, maybe China-Taiwan tensions, that they have you there?
Yeah, so ever since the end of World War II, the Marines and really the military, U.S. military, has never left Okinawa. So after the Battle of Okinawa in 1945, we kind of just stayed. And Okinawa itself, if you actually were to drive around Okinawa or look at a map, it is base after base after base. So you have Air Force out here. You have small Army presence, but you have a lot of Marine Corps. So we were out here just, I mean, I guess you can say occupying Okinawa ever since the end of the war. Mm-hmm. And yeah, as China has kind of become the big player out here, now Okinawa is even more valuable because it's proximity to Taiwan.
Do you get to take weekend getaways?
Weekend getaways usually go to mainland Japan because they treat us like we're little children, right? So you can only go so far over a weekend. When you have longer breaks, like 3-day weekends or 4-day weekends, depending on the holidays, have a chance to go travel a little bit more. We've gone to Singapore. That's where I've gone. The family's traveled a lot. I mean, they spent the first month not with me. They went to Bali, to Philippines, to Vietnam. They went to Australia, New Zealand, and Fiji just recently. So basically any time that I have like a big exercise or if I'm out of pocket for a long time, I just tell them, go ahead and get out of here. We'll check out of our Airbnb. We'll save that money and you guys go fly and travel. So, I mean, they're enjoying it. Not quite the same for me, but it's good.
You're providing the funds to be able to do that, I guess, huh?
Yeah. 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 I mean, these kids, two boys, they're 9 years old and, very similar to, I'm sure, your daughter, like have a chance to see, you know, all these different places through travel. And it's, it's really been great. I mean, you can definitely tell that they have a broader perspective on the world for having traveled all the places they've been.
That's awesome. So we should tell listeners how we know each other. You were 2 years behind me in school, correct? You graduated 2000?
Yeah, that's right.
And you played baseball. You guys are pretty good.
Man, it's funny. I listen to you and Chase talk, and it brings back so many memories because I remember being, showing up as a freshman, and that leap from coming from junior high to high school, especially at a place like Sci Falls, is huge. I mean, I remember walking that first day in, and, you come from being eighth grader, kind of the big kid on campus, walk in as a freshman in high school, and you're like a little child. And you guys are grown men, and, just like looking up to you guys. And, but I look back at that time at Sci Falls and watching you play, watching Chase play, watching, Jamie Bubella play. I mean, we had a lot of talent in Houston at that time, but I think in general, just that whole Cypress area just churned out a lot of really good baseball players.
Big time. And I can relate to what you're talking about, because when I got on campus, it was Kristinik, Bubella, Cracky, who else? Rutherford. I mean, those guys were men. And I looked up to them like they were college athletes. I mean, they were driving trucks and such a big deal. I really looked up to them. And Kirk Kristinik, God, he was like the biggest high schooler I had ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
And so trying to get to the varsity was like, am I ever going to play varsity at school like this? So, but you guys were stacked, and you got to play for the coach McDonald, Brent McDonald, who I've had on the podcast. Great.
I did.
Man, I love that dude. What was it like playing for him?
Coach Mack is great. And I look back, it's funny. I look back a lot, believe it or not, during those high school years with just a little bit of regret in a way, because
me too.
I mean, when I reflect back in my baseball career, and I was lucky. I got a chance to play in college at the Naval Academy as well. So I went on and played a little college ball, but I think the problem that I had a lot of really decent physical gifts. Like I was pretty fast, decent power. I was great in the field, loved playing outfield, center field, could track down any baseball that was hit out there. But I did not have control of my heart. Like I wore my heart on my sleeve, and I didn't have anybody that really, I'm not saying this is Coach Mack, this was more of me. Like I did not have anybody sit down with me and work with me on the head part of the game. Like getting your headspace right, getting your heart under control. Cause I played with a lot of passion and that served me well at some times, but man, I tell you, like it got away from me a couple times. You had already gone on, so you may not remember this, but I know my teammates did. I'm left-handed and I hit from the right side. And then I taught myself how to hit left-handed. So my senior year, I switch hit. So I go from, never batting from the left side of the plate to senior year in high school hitting left-handed. And the thought process was, man, I was going to lay down some bunts and just track it over to first base. I could actually see the ball better from the left side of the plate too. I have like this depth perception thing. So better bat control, better vision, but I just didn't quite have the swing down. And yeah, I probably looking back, I think that I left a little bit on the field probably by getting distracted by that. But I tell you what, I love playing. I miss my teammates, and I will vividly remember the day when we get eliminated in the playoffs by Klein Oak. And I just remember dropping down to my knees and just crying like a little baby. These are guys that you play with like ever since you were little, and to have it end, it's just, I didn't have that same feeling when my career ended in college. It just wasn't the same.
And you played all 4 years in college?
So yeah, I went to the Naval Academy. I played, we have kind of like a junior varsity team and then the traveling, team. I made the traveling team as a sophomore. And man, Brad, I was always good at like fall ball. I would rake in fall ball. And I remember I got my junior year, I got a chance to start, and was making contact, but just wasn't really punching him through. And I think in 2.5 years of playing, man, I might have played in like 40 or 50 games, but only had like 48 at bats. we had a center fielder that was gifted, but he just had like a bum arm. So if the games were tight, I would come in and sub in for him and, you know, just be a defensive sub. So I played a lot that way. So I think I have like 5 or 6 career hits in college. nothing big, but yeah, those are the days. But I will say this, that talent level in the Cypress, you know, kind of Northwest Houston area, I didn't see that in college. The high school talent was just so much better. So much better. I mean, you look back and you're taking fastballs from Josh Beckett. You know, curveballs, like you're seeing a guy throw like that. And I mean, I didn't really see that playing, you know, where we played at the Naval Academy. Although, funny story, we did go down to Old Dominion. This was 2003. This is like pre cell phones. Like nobody knows who anybody is. You just see Old Dominion on the schedule. You don't know any of these guys. And this real tall, skinny right-hander is warming up and he's just throwing BBs. And I'm like, who is this dude? It was Verlander. So that's a blast right there when you hop in the plate with Justin Verlander and it makes you look like you're just nothing.
Yeah, I can see that. So I, contrary to you, I was a little scrappy left-hander too and played center field. I didn't have a problem with my heart or the emotional side of the game. I remember seeing Joe DiMaggio when I was little. And do you remember that clip of him where he hit the ball? Maybe he was robbed of a home run or the guy caught it on the warning track and he just kind of kicked the dirt. And they always praised him for that, for his mentality and attitude. And so I always tried to take that attitude into playing baseball. But also, unlike you, what I struggled with, I could track down any ball in center field, but I didn't learn until late in my career that if you open your mouth when you're running full speed, the ball will stop jumping around. So I missed balls in the outfield because of that, because the ball would move at the last minute. And I'm like, why is the ball moving? And why did no coach ever tell me to open my mouth? Did you know about that?
I don't know if I knew about that, but maybe I just kept my mouth open the whole time. I'm not sure.
Or maybe I clinch too much. I do tend to clinch like at night, so I wear a mouth guard.
Oh.
But maybe that was it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're just clinching.
Yeah, because another thing I didn't learn how to do, and again, you and I were fast, probably naturally for the most part, but there's a fluidity. Like I had a former Olympic sprinter on the podcast, and he was telling me all about the mechanics of running and how much practice they get to learn how to run. I didn't know anything about learning how to run. Mm-hmm. So I would just probably clench up and tighten up and just, you know, as fast as I could. Yeah. And then after I finished baseball, I'm learning all about how you learn how to run. Like, how does nobody teach me this?
Yeah. It's funny because now sports, it's such a business, even at the high school level. But I look back at the teammates that I had, like Cole Kors and a lot of those guys. And I wish that I had, it wasn't that I didn't have the same work ethic. I just didn't really have anybody that was guiding me on the process of like being a better baseball player, you know, connecting to the head. Yeah, I remember there was actually one practice. Coach McDonald would probably remember this, and I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but I mean, this is life, right? We were practicing.
Well, sorry, let me interject. Let me warn you. Yeah. He probably will listen to this.
Yeah, so he'll remember this. He hit a ball out to me in the outfield, and I picked it up and I probably skipped it to the cutoff, man. Just bad throw. And Mac had a way of setting the tone, and he set the tone of that practice by, after that throw, he took us off the field. Mm-hmm. And I remember being so mad, really at myself, and probably so embarrassed that I ran off the field, hid somewhere and cried. Like
you did have an emotional problem.
And I mean, well, and, you know, the thing is, the reality is like, it's taken me to, you know, 43 years old to realize the gift that actually is. But it's harnessing that heart energy in a different way. It was uncontrolled when I was younger, but now I understand how to work with it. But yeah, when I was 16, 17 years old, I didn't know how to control that.
And you probably at that age, and I suffered from this too, you probably couldn't express what you needed, almost like a baby.
Yeah, I don't know. I just know that when I look back, I think of those moments and I'm like, man, if I just had a way of just tamping that down or directing that energy or having a different mental approach to the game, maybe it would have been different. But I mean, who knows? I mean, I wasn't going to go play professional baseball or anything. So,
yeah, I think we're too soon old, too late smart. And I think a lot of life and having success is figuring out how to prevent that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, as much as I say that I have regrets, I look back and it was still a lot of fun. Like you said, I mean, I had a really, really good set of teammates. And actually in 2003, we made the NCAA tournament, Naval Academy. We were kind of watching like where we were going to get, what region we were going to get put in. And I was sure hoping that we would have gotten put into the Rice region, like to play Rice, because that was Dane Bubella, Chris Colcours, like the whole crew. And we didn't, but I was dreaming for a moment.
Did you guys play in some big non-conference games, like get to play in front of some large crowds?
I mean, we would go play like Service Academy tournaments where we'd play Arkansas. We got the chance to play against Arkansas, Notre Dame, of course, Army. I mean, so some big schools. I remember we went down to Florida one time and played a school called Stetson. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, Stetson. Mm-hmm. Man, they smoked us. They smoked us. Yeah.
Arkansas is probably one of the best parks to play in. Was it a rowdy crowd?
We didn't play at Arkansas. We played in Tennessee at the Olympic Stadium out in, was it Millington, Tennessee?
Okay. And so were you in school with Steve Mercer, the tight end?
Yeah. Yeah. Steve was a year or two ahead of me, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And you see him around campus in the locker room?
A little building? Bit. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, believe it or not, between baseball, being busy with baseball, and I actually got in trouble a couple times at the academy, I almost got kicked out. That's a whole story. I didn't really get out and socialize a lot. So there's a lot of people that they talk about, hey, do you remember going to this bar or doing this thing? And I'm always like, nope. Cause
how do you
I
get
never
kicked
got
out without socializing?
So the Naval Academy has like these really special rules, and it's all predicated on trying to create naval officers that have high integrity. So they're called MIDREGs, midshipman regulations. And they're rules that are on top of what's already called UCMJ. So one of them, for example, is when you are, say, a sophomore, junior, or senior, you can't date freshmen. So one of the times that I got in trouble was because I was seeing a freshman and got
caught.
Was
he cute?
I knew you were going to go there. Yeah, so I got in trouble for that and actually got forwarded for separation. So it's a whole process. You get forwarded for separation at each level. And I was at the next level that if I got separated, I was going to go back into the fleet, basically serve out my commitment as an enlisted sailor, because I'd already signed what's called these commitment papers. So that was a rough time, but I made it.
It must have been exciting because she was forbidden fruit. You must have known you were breaking the rules, huh? She was worth it.
I definitely knew I was breaking the rules. And you know, when you're a young man, sometimes you don't think about those things. You think that you can get away with it. And I thought I could.
Still think about her every once in a while?
Nah, not too much. Not too much. That was a different time in my life, man.
Yeah. Oh, I know. And your wife's going to listen to this probably.
Yeah, so, she knows. She knows.
I've told you this before, but guys like me, we don't know a lot of guys like you. I have maybe one or two friends who went into the military. And if I remember in high school, the guys that I knew that did go into the military typically didn't have any direction in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an avenue that they could go to learn discipline and that sort of thing. A lot of them came from broken homes. Did you always want to be in the military, or how did you think about that? Did you have any good friends from high school that were doing that?
Yeah.
Or did you go to play baseball? Give it to me. Tell me.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. The first thing that really started to stoke my interest in going to one of the service academies was My step grandfather, so my stepdad's father, was a World War II vet, and I went to his funeral, and that was the first time that I had seen military honors at a funeral. And I just remember having such admiration and pride for this man who was this, I mean, he was a World War II guy. So he was very, very quiet, very stoic, didn't really talk about a whole lot. And to have that opportunity to watch that, I just remember being 14 years old and thinking, man, that's amazing. So that was the first thing. And the second thing is, I mean, just like you, man, I'm a child of the 80s and 90s. So Top Gun had a huge influence on me. I used to think that it would be the coolest thing in the world to hop in a jet, take off some aircraft carrier, land, hop on my motorcycle, go play some volleyball with the boys and some jeans, go chase around some girls in a flight jacket. Like, that seemed really cool to me. So when I showed up to Sci Falls, actually, I already knew that I wanted to go to the Naval Academy. So I kind of plotted, that seems like a terrible word to use, but I planned my whole high school experience around making myself competitive to go to the Naval Academy, because it takes a lot, because you have to get a Congress appointment. You have to, you know, show that you're well-rounded. Like, it's a whole thing. So I knew I wanted to go to the Naval Academy basically as a freshman, and that was my singular goal.
And did you have to walk on at the Naval Academy to play baseball, or how did that work?
I mean, they didn't come out and do a visit and recruit me. I showed up. You know, it might have been the summer of my what we call plebe year, and they have an idea of who the athletes are, and, you know, especially baseball, they don't really have much of a budget, at least at that time, for recruiting. So it's kind of like a tryout. And then showed them my skills, and they were like, "All right, you're on the team." So that was pretty much that from there.
That's awesome. And so you had to go to PT and all that?
I mean, yeah, the Naval Academy is a pretty...
Not PT. What is it called? I'm sorry. I'm going to have to delete this. I am so ignorant about the military, and I apologize. No, what is it called? BT, right? Basic training.
Yeah, they call it... At the Naval Academy, it's called Plebe Summer. And you show up... I think I'd left home. It might have been like June 28th. Showed up July 1st. So right after graduation, and you spend that whole summer going through... You know, what you would call basic training. And it's like shaving the head, running around, getting yelled at, early wake ups, learning all this stuff, just a lot of discipline, a lot of getting messed around with, and, you know, just trying to break you down and rebuild you up. So yeah, I did that.
And was the goal to always be a fighter pilot? You always had Maverick in the back of your mind?
I always did. And then September 11th happened. So that was my sophomore year at the academy. And it's funny, because at the Naval Academy, and this is something that I may not understand. So the Naval service includes both the Navy and the Marine Corps. So the Marine Corps is part of the Department of the Navy. So when you go to the Naval Academy, you'll see Navy officers and Marine officers. And when you graduate, you get the option of going Navy or Marines. Now, they restrict how many people can go into the Marine Corps. It's like 1 out of 6. It's like a mandated thing. It could only be 1 out of 6. So mostly Navy and a few Marine officers. But when I first showed up to the academy, I looked at the Marines and I'm like, these dudes are too gung ho. They have terrible haircuts. They have like fierce attitudes. The Navy guys are so much more laid back and cool. But then when September 11th happened, I mean, everything changed because, and this isn't like a dig at my Navy brethren. It just became very apparent that if you wanted to go fight, you wanted to be a Marine. If you weren't going to be a Navy SEAL, which there are very few of those, if you wanted to go overseas and take the fight to the enemy, you wanted to be a Marine. So pretty much after September 11th, I knew I wanted to be a Marine. And then I met a Cobra pilot my junior year. That's the aircraft that I would eventually fly. And he had just come back from the invasion of Iraq. And he was showing me all these videos from his flights. And they had put this whole thing up and music and all that. And I was sold. I said, that's what I want to do. I want to be a Cobra attack helicopter pilot. And I did.
That's so cool, man. Do you remember what the atmosphere was like after 9/11 and where you were? Like, I remember I never turned on the TV for whatever reason. I turned it on that morning. I usually didn't have time. I'd make coffee and I'd almost go to school in my pajamas. But that morning I turned the TV on and I saw what had happened. And then I was in accounting class when the second plane hit the towers and somebody came in and told us, and then we just continued on with class. And then when I got home, I was in front of the TV almost 72 hours straight if I didn't have to be at class or at baseball practice. And I remember the guy that I stayed with during summer ball in Kansas sent me an American flag sticker to put on my car. And I did. And what I remember those next few days is how nice everybody was. And if you came to a stop sign, despite you being the second, third one there, everybody was like, no, you go, you go, you go. It was so, such a unique time. What was it like for you? Do you remember that time? And where were you?
Yeah, so I was a sophomore at the Naval Academy, and you go into the military wanting to serve your country. And then this idea of war, of actually going to war, is something that you work towards, but it's way off in the distance. After September 11th, it was right there in front of us, right there in front of us. In fact, I don't remember who the first Marines that were at the academy that went over and died. I think it might have been, I had an electrical engineering professor, Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Shea. So I would have taken electrical engineering. It might have been my junior. I think that next year when I was a senior, I think he was killed in Iraq. And then one of our star football players, Ron Winchester, was one of the first ones. And then one of our quarterbacks, JP Blecksmith. And then you start getting the names and you're like, man, I remember seeing that dude walking down the hall and he's gone. So it became, that was the environment that I graduated in. You know, I graduated in 2004. Iraq was definitely pretty hot. Afghanistan, you know, it was the 2001 invasion, and that kind of fell in the background for a little bit. But yeah, big difference coming in as a freshman, thinking I was going to like play volleyball and chase around girls, to now wanting to become a Marine and get in the dirt and go take the fight to the enemy. It's a major shift.
What was your first deployment?
I deployed in 2008 to Iraq. It was actually the first time I'd ever left the United States, believe it or not. I'd never
Wow.
been outside of the US until Iraq. It was my first time leaving the United States. Funny. Iraq in 2008 was really quiet. So a lot of activity. 2006, 2007, those would have been some very busy years. Obviously 2003 in the first part of the invasion. When I showed up in 2008, it was really actually quite quiet. So that deployment was my first, you know, so-called combat deployment, but I didn't have an opportunity to pull a trigger. I mean, I supported a lot of what we call CASAVAC missions, where you're escorting or flying with a helicopter that's going to pick up somebody that's injured. But that deployment was pretty quiet. But I came back from that deployment. President Obama had gotten elected, and people don't maybe remember this, but one of the first things that he did is he ordered a surge into Afghanistan. So I volunteered to go to a different squadron and deploy to Afghanistan in 2009. 2009 deployment in Afghanistan was very, very busy, very kinetic, totally much more different than Iraq.
Why did it take so long for you to be deployed? It was 4 years or so.
Yeah. It's flight school. So I graduated in 2004. It takes a couple of years to make a pilot. So you got to go through kind of like the ground training, and then you learn how to fly a fixed wing aircraft. And then you learn how to fly a helicopter, and then you go to your fleet training squadron and learn how to fly your helicopter. And then you go to an actual, what we call line squadron, and then you learn how to fight that helicopter. So that whole process takes 2 years at least.
So why the switch from wanting to be Maverick in a plane to helicopter?
Just when I met that Marine I mentioned in my junior year, and I saw what he did as a attack helicopter pilot, I knew I wanted to do that. Because helicopters, especially a Cobra, the mission's different. It's just two pilots. We sit in tandem. We're not carrying troops or anything. We got little stub wings, rockets, Hellfire, laser guided missiles, and 20 millimeter cannon. Like, we're made to go get stuff. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be in that. I wanted to fly low and, you know, be close to the action. I mean, again, this is no disrespect to my jet bros that are out there, but those guys love, you know, they love wearing their glasses and having nice hair and flying at 20,000 feet and dropping 500 pound bombs. Like, it's not really that big of a deal to them, but to be closer to the action, to be in the thick of it, that's what I wanted to do.
And you were, you said when you arrived in Afghanistan in 2009, it was very kinetic. So tell me what that was like.
So 2009, I mean, when I went to Iraq, I thought Iraq was pretty desolate and backwards, and not backwards, but just underdeveloped. But looking back, Iraq was actually pretty well developed. There's a lot going on, especially around Baghdad and some of the other big cities. But man, you go to Afghanistan, and we started out in Kandahar, which is a big city, but then we eventually moved to a place called Bastion. So it's like west across the desert into kind of the heart of Helmand province. And I mean, you are flying around seeing people that probably haven't changed how they live since the biblical times. Like, it's, I mean, a lot of Bedouin, kind of just random people out in the desert. The fighting was a lot more intense, especially in the summer months, because the Taliban would sell all their heroin and their poppy in the spring months, and then that would equip and fund their operations, and then the weather would be better. So the summer months were always pretty busy. We also, in 2009, because of that surge, we started pushing in a lot more Marines throughout the Helmand River Valley. And, you know, once you put in Marines and you start running into some bad guys, you start stirring up a hornet's nest, and it's what we did. So that was a lot more chaotic, a lot more busy.
Do some of the American troops get hooked on heroin and stuff like that? Does it get in their hands? And
No. Not that I'm aware of. Never saw that. Not like Vietnam. I know that was an issue back then.
Yeah. You guys, I mean, you probably feel a brotherhood with your fellow troops that I can't understand. And I remember running into a buddy of mine who had been deployed. I saw him at a wedding, and I was so excited to see him. He was a real good friend in high school, actually. And I tried to give him a hug, and he was just so cold and distant. And I thought, I have a brotherhood with my buddies. I love my buddies. I die for them, but it's got to be so different. And I thought, when he didn't hug me back, I thought, oh, he's got different brothers now that I can't relate to. Can you talk about what you feel for your guys and what, tell me about that. I'm just fascinated by it.
Yeah. I mean, being in a squadron, especially what we call an HMLA, that's Marine Light Attack Helicopter Squadron. That's the squadron I came from, has Cobras and Hueys. I mean, it's a very, you get to be tight with the guys you deploy with, especially in that early 2009 deployment, because we're sleeping in tents and it's just like open living, and you're flying these missions all day, and it can get pretty spicy and fun. And you're doing what you were trained to do, and you're doing it well and being excellent at something, which is great. And then after the shift is over, you're coming back home and you're talking about the missions and supporting the Marines on the ground and doing all the things that you had worked so hard to get to. And so you get to be pretty tight with guys, especially your combat crew that you fly with. It does get pretty competitive though in the HMLA, because there's progression to quals and competitiveness. And so there's some dynamics that go on with that. But some of those guys that I flew with and trained with and deployed with, yeah, I love them. Love them to death.
Do you remember the first person you lost that was close to you?
Yeah. So that would have been on that deployment. So it wasn't the first person that I lost. I'd actually lost a friend at the Naval Academy. He had fallen out of his window. And then throughout flight school, I mean, it's funny. It's hard, but it's true. They start you off in flight school, and you look around the room, and it's, you know, they tell you like, hey, some of you guys will not make it. And not only will wash out of the program, but you actually won't be alive in a few years, like statistically, because naval aviation is dangerous in general. So even in my training pipeline, we had a fatal crash that happened in both of my training squadrons, where just something happened and those guys crashed and didn't make it. So it's not always combat where a lot of this happens. Most fatal mishaps happen naval aviation in training environments. But in that 2009 deployment, we were a few weeks away from going home, and I was at in a place called Dwyer, so like another little base. And we were going off a shift. So the day crew guys came in, and the mission was, there was like this high value target, like really important person that was out there. And there was, I think it was Army Rangers that had come in and done this little planning to get this guy, and they needed some escorts. So our helicopters were going to escort these CH-47s. So big helicopters with a bunch of Army Rangers, and they were going to go take this guy. And it was dark, low light. So there's no moon, and our guys take off, and they take off what's called in trail. So you have one aircraft in front, one aircraft in the back. And the challenge is when you take off in trail like this and you're wearing night vision goggles, those NVGs, because you're looking at the pipes, you don't get peripheral motion. So you don't really have a sense of how fast you're traveling, right? Mm-hmm. You have to look at your gauges, and just, if you're just looking on the pipes and looking at closure rates with your eyes, you can be deceived. And what essentially happened is the Dash 2 or the wingman aircraft had an excessive closure rate and smashed into the lead aircraft and killed four of the guys in that crash. Two guys survived, but yeah, we lost four that day. So
Jesus.
I mean, it's hard, but it's like the details of that get really, really tough. Cause I remember one of the guys was weeks away from seeing the birth of a son, and it just didn't happen. You know, it's really, yeah. Those are the things that kind of shape you.
Do you remember the story of Pat Tillman?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I used to have Pat, that Sports Illustrated of him, his hair all flying around. He's in the Arizona mm-hmm. Cardinals uniform when he died. I used to have that thing framed.
I still have it, too. Yeah. My dad subscribed to SI for a long time. Did they lie about what happened? What happened there?
I don't remember all the details of that, but I think that they were not very truthful in the fact that, as I recall, and I would have to brush up on the facts here, but I think it was a blue-on-blue incident where basically they shot each other. There was some confusion, and I think that detail was never initially presented, and I think an alternative story might have been presented, one that made the situation look different. That's my recollection of it.
So you mentioned escorts. How does it work when you're in a sandy desert for a long time with a bunch of dudes? Like, I've read where concentration camps and people who are in prison for a long time, they actually lose their sex drive. How does that work? Like, you have no access to women.
I don't know. I've listened to your podcast, so I wonder if I could tell stories, because I know you get a little edgy on things, so I kind of wonder if I should even tell the story or not.
Throwing myself on edge, please proceed.
No, I mean, I'm trying to think the best, most sanitized way to say this. No, I mean, I don't think guys lose their sexual appetite. They just get really creative with where they go, you know? 2009, I mean, your options are pretty slim because you lived in a tent. So you're usually with like 10 other guys. You might have noticed guys that spent a little extra time in the Port-a-John, you know, that might be one place.
Back in the days of magazines, huh?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We didn't have, that was it. Old school.
For cigarettes. Yeah. No FaceTime.
Nothing.
Man, that had to be rough. It's not like you can go into Kabul to the gentleman's club or anything.
Yeah. Nope. None of that.
Speaking of concentration camps, I'm in Krakow and my wife is going to Auschwitz tomorrow because I've been before. So she's going to go check it out. Have you been to a concentration camp?
Yes. I went to Oh man, the name is going to escape me. It was in Germany. It's one of the ones that's in Germany, which there's probably a few. Which one is it? If you threw it out there, I would remember the name, but this is a good example. Dachau. Yeah, it would have been Dachau. Yeah.
Yeah, it's right outside of Munich.
Yep. Yeah.
So can I ask your thoughts on even going into Iraq and Afghanistan in the first place? I know it sounded like you were excited initially, as we all kind of were, to get revenge for 9/11. Mm-hmm. But has your view of any of that changed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. My view on it has definitely evolved over time, because it's difficult, because I think Iraq and Afghanistan are really good test cases for two different situations. And what I mean by that is, like, Afghanistan, I think that is a great example of where, in my view, just my personal opinion, I wonder if we really had a good vision of what we were actually doing, because we went into Afghanistan to get bin Laden. Like, that was the number one goal. Then we got kind of what I would say sidetracked with this project of, hey, let's democratize Afghanistan and, you know, bring in all of these human rights to women and children and all of this. All of those things sound great, but that's a really, really difficult thing to do. And all of a sudden, like, the Taliban, who you can make the argument really didn't have a whole lot to do with September 11th, other than the fact that they basically allowed Osama bin Laden to have real estate from which to train and plan and recruit fighters. The Taliban were essentially a group of fanatical Muslim leaders that had a very, from our view, backwards way of living. I don't know if that really justifies being there for 20 years, but we got into that quagmire with no real way of defining what success was. I mean, we always used to say, like, and I think it's true, if you wanted to do Afghanistan right, you would need to be there for at least two generations to culturally change the mindset of the children that are growing up in that environment. But then that's also difficult if, you know, and I mean, this is a memory that I have, is you fly these missions where a guy, presumably a father, is out there showing his son how to rig up an IED. There was a mission that I flew on where I think the boy might have been 11, and he's with an older man that I presume to be his dad, and his dad's like setting up the wire, all of this, and I was approved to put a missile on that guy, and I did, and kill him, injure the boy, but the boy survives. So what happens to that boy? Like, what does his worldview now look like? It's probably not positive towards us. And you extrapolate that out hundreds of times, however often it happens, throughout probably thousands of times throughout that whole 20-year experience. And I don't really know how you change that place. So, long-winded way to say, in my view, Afghanistan should have always been, hey, let's get really tight. Let's get really surgical. We're going after bin Laden. And when we do that, we're out. The Taliban, run your show. That's up to you. It's not our game, but you do that. Iraq, I think that one's difficult, because I think we now know that the intelligence that we used to get us into that war may not have been there. And I think that's fair. I think it's interesting, because there was some negotiating that was happening from the United States and Iraq, where we wanted to get access to certain sites, and Saddam wasn't giving us access. And so that didn't really help the situation, because ultimately we were saying, if you give us access, then we're good. But if you don't, we're going to make you. And he said, well, you're not coming in. The reason why he was playing coy on that is because he's a Sunni in a dominant Shia country, and he's got to maintain his credibility against Iran. So if he shows all of his cards that he doesn't have these weapons, he's showing that he's weak against Iran. and now he's undermined. So you can almost turn the map around from Saddam's perspective and say that dude was in between a rock and a hard place. I don't know if that's enough to justify kicking down the door, but what I would say, and I think most Iraq veterans who spent the early part of that war would probably agree, the Iraq war was over in 3 weeks. Like we marched up from Kuwait. We took Baghdad. Saddam was in a hole in the ground. One option that we could have done is look around and say, all right, you see what we did? You see how quickly we dismantled your army. Which one of you dudes wants to take over and run this country? We're going to go look for Saddam. And then we could have left. Mm-hmm. I mean, once we demonstrated that ability to take Baghdad within 3 weeks, I mean, maybe I'm naive, but I would have thought that we could have put in some other puppet dictator that would be a little bit more compliant to us because he saw mm-hmm. how quickly they got stacked. But I mean, again, I mean, I know you get into some of this calm conspiracy theories, but they all turn out to be true. You start looking at the money that was being made and the defense contracting and Halliburton. And then you start to wonder, man, maybe we really weren't optimizing for the right success.
Maybe some money laundering going on.
Something.
And are these conversations you have in the tent with your guys while you're deployed?
No, not then. I would say the only time that we ever had probably some marginally political frustrated conversations was maybe in 2010 when I was back in Afghanistan. We were fighting in a place called Sangin, and it was really, really, really brutal, like really tough fighting. The Marines on the ground, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines in particular, they had a really, really tough deployment. And what harder is back home, President Obama was talking about, hey, we need to start withdrawing. We need to start like cycling down. We need to start like pulling back and rethinking our strategy in Afghanistan, which probably was the right call. But what message are you sending to that Marine, that 19-year-old kid from Mississippi who has to run across a poppy field into gunfire to take some building that we know that we're going to give away in a few years? You know, it's like, what are we actually fighting for? And again, that's where I go into the confusion of like Afghanistan, where guys are just going and going and going. I mean, I spent between Iraq and Afghanistan, I've spent 30 months of my life in those two countries. You invest a lot in it. You spend a lot of time, you lose friends. And to watch, I mean, even watch how we got out of there, man. Like, I mean, what a wild experience watching Air Force C-5s take off and Afghans are like clinging to the wheels, trying to hope that they can get on the plane. I mean, just wild. Yeah. So no, we never really talked about those things. I mean, again, 2010 was probably the closest to it, but I mean, when you're in that environment, you're just thinking, what's the mission? How am I going to do it? What am I going to do after that? You mostly talk about coming home and like learning French, starting a beer company, like all these things that you're going to do when you get back. Like that's really the kind of talk that you're really leaning on is all these fantasies that you're going to have when you get back home.
I was going to ask about the withdrawal. I also wanted to ask about your thoughts on the search for white supremacy within the military. Was that a joke or it wasn't a joke?
I mean, it wasn't a joke. I sort of remember that. When was that? Was that, what year was that?
Maybe 21. As soon as Biden got in office.
Yeah.
I mean, that was our biggest existential threat, white supremacy.
Yeah. Part of it is when, you know, I got out of active duty in 2014, and as a reservist, I probably didn't really keep my tabs on a lot of things that were going on, especially in 2021, man. I was a ghost at that time.
Mm-hmm. So like Mark Milley, Lloyd Austin, you don't have opinions on those guys?
No. I kept my head down those years, so I would have missed that.
I posted a story on social media of Abrams tanks that were purchased from America. Yeah. And so I was in Gdańsk, Poland, and they were traveling by on the train, and I took a video. And you remember what you told me in response?
Yeah, I was actually listening to your podcast show where you just talked about that. And I was like, oh man, he's talking about me. And I started getting excited and nervous. And I was like, oh man. Yeah. So yeah, that's a cool video. What's wild, there's so much that's rapidly changing with warfare right now. And the drones, these what we call small UAS or FPVs, these things have completely leveled the playing field, especially in Ukraine. You've talked a little bit about this, and it's interesting. Effectively, what we're seeing and what we have seen is, and I think Ukraine's probably getting a little help, but for the most part, you have a country that has no business thwarting the advance of Russia, and yet they are, for the most part. I mean, it's coming at tremendous cost. I mean, that story you told of a 19-year-old girl whose father was killed in Ukraine, like, that's real. I mean, the Ukrainians are losing an entire generation of men fighting this war. So it's not coming at a small cost. That said, these drones are allowing the Ukrainians to do something they shouldn't be able to do, which is keep back the Russian army, and not only keep them back, but actually send Ukrainians into Russia and attack targets that you couldn't even dream of hitting with these drones. And so, yeah, when you sent that video, you could take a $300 drone and with a, you know, 5-pound shape charge, slam it into a tank, and that tank is toast. So these advanced weapons that Russia's built, that we've built, now you got these little drone guys who are flying around, and it's game over.
Wow. So the future of warfare will be robots and drones, you think?
It's already happening. It's just the question is, how fast is it going to happen, and what are the responses to the innovation efforts? Because the early drones, there was a lot of lessons learned. A lot of them are remote controlled, and then you can start to jam those radio signals. So the response is, well, now we're going to like control them by wire. So a lot of the drones that are flowing in Ukraine right now are actually tethered to a wire, because now you can't jam those. You see the tanks put up like all these nets, and I mean, it's really what warfare is. It's just innovation after innovation. But for sure, it's very clear that the pivot to this is scaling your defenses, especially with drones. And I've actually can't talk too much about it on this podcast, but I've actually seen this out here. I was supporting an exercise where effectively a small group of operators, it's really like 5 guys, just with a couple drones were able to hem up a much larger unit that they shouldn't have been able to do that. I mean, they would have destroyed like dozens of vehicles, handful of aircraft, like simple, all with just some dude playing on a controller, just flying things with explosives into vehicles. It's wild.
So the military might be recruiting gamers, right? Like, are they training in the military now to just operate drones?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a big push for drones. Yeah, and I mean, I'm not too smart on this, but I've talked to people who are much more well-versed, mostly because, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm a reservist, so my give a damn about a lot of this is not what it used to be. But I think the challenge is our innovation cycle from the United States military is pretty slow. The Ukrainians are turning around and innovating on their drones very quickly, but they also don't have a military industrial complex where everybody's got to get their hand in the pie, and you got to have these, you know, big defense contracts that take years to RFP and get through. I talked to a guy who knows a little bit more about this than I do, talking about certain drone systems that we could deploy. And he's like, yeah, we'll have it by 2030. It's like, well, 2030, man, like China's talking about taking Taiwan by 2027. So we're going to be a couple years late on that one.
Yeah, it sounds like Ukraine's lack of vision mimics what you guys experienced in Afghanistan. Why? How is that should be number one. Like, what is the objective?
Yeah, it's tough, Brad, because I've listened to many of your episodes, and you were talking about one, like, it's a very hard topic. And we are always taught in the Marine Corps that war is actually the very end of a political process. So it's the last step of a political process. So you go through diplomacy, negotiation, you go through all these stages. And then when you can't settle that disagreement, you fight. So it is a process by which political outcomes are made. And I know it's way more complicated than either you or me can possibly figure out, and who knows where it's going to go. But much like you, at some point, I wonder when somebody just says enough is enough, like in exchange for some land or whatever, we have to move on from this. And I think people who oppose that are going to say, well, that's going to embolden Putin to do more. And, you know, I can see that perspective, but I don't really see Putin rolling into Poland or other countries, because look what he did to Ukraine. The Russian military has been smacked pretty hard by a military that has no business being on the same battlefield with Russia.
Yeah, that, and it's taken, what, 3 years to conquer 20% of Ukraine on the eastern side? I mean, what does that tell us? It would take 30 years to take Poland and Hungary and Czech Republic, and he has no intention, Putin, I mean, has no intention of doing that, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But people here are scared. I talk to Europeans who are scared of that.
Yeah, I mean, and I on the one hand, I can understand it, but I also would wonder if they really are thinking about, and there's no reason why they would, the dynamics of warfare as we are talking about it right now have dramatically changed because of drones. And I know for a fact, I would at least assume, that China is thinking the same damn thing with Taiwan. There's only like 100 miles that separate China from Taiwan. When you look at the time-space problem, it doesn't really seem like that hard. But it's a lot more complicated than just like swinging some ships over, throwing in some dudes and taking Taiwan, especially when you see what's happening in Ukraine.
You think they would do to Taiwan what they did to Hong Kong, basically?
I think it's different because you have to get over to Taiwan. Like, you actually have to cross a body of water, put troops in the ground. There's only so many landing sites they can do that on. And I am not able to speak to the preparedness of the Taiwanese, nor our response to that. But I think that the calculus is a lot more difficult than people assume it to be.
So I saw your post. You're an excellent writer. You wrote a post about retiring from the military. Why did you do that? And what does that mean in terms of pension and career, and now you're a reservist? Yeah. I'm an ignoramus when it comes to all this, so fill me in, bro.
Well, I mean, first of all, thanks for the compliment. Like, I like writing, and I don't know, it's sometimes the muse strikes me, and I feel like I gotta get down and start writing things. It's an interesting process. But yeah, I came to the kind of conclusion maybe like 5 or 6 weeks ago that, you know, I've been in the military since I was 17, and it's just time to hang them up. I mean, even as a reservist with one foot in, one foot out, there's just other things that I want to work on in life that aren't really, best way I can say it, aren't really compatible with serving in the military, even as a reservist. And honestly, I mean, my wife's excited about this. Like, I have too many things that I'm working on that it's just time to cut one of them and let it go. And so I've given everything that I could possibly give to the Marine Corps. And at some point, the Marine Corps doesn't really give it back. And that's the point where you got to hang them up. So it felt like a big release because, like I said, I have not known anything other than either wanting to serve or actively serving since I was 14 years old. So that's 30 years now of my life that this has been ingrained in me. But now it's just time to move on to different projects, man. Like, different phase of life, right? Like,
yeah. You're a business guy now, like me.
I try. This is probably not the best time to talk, but maybe I can get you on my podcast. I want to definitely hear more about you getting into coaching and you helping out all the guys. I love your interviews with some of the guys that you coach, man. Like, that's, you really get to come out and see your impact on them, but also see the quality of people that you work with.
Yes, they're studs, man. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that on your pod. You can ask questions now, but I'm really excited to get to know you more. So, like, do you get to keep the pension? How does that work when you retire?
Yeah, it's a little different than active duty. So I will get a pension when I'm 60, and it's a fraction of what active duty guys get. It's basically, there's like some funny money math that happens with it based on how many days you served, how many points you got, but essentially that's what it is.
All right, here's a more personal question. So when I got out of college, my first year, full year out of college, I made $22,000. And then I think second year was like 48. Do you start that low in the military? And then do you get up to six figures?
As an officer, I don't remember what I got paid. You get paid more as an officer. Yeah. And then you layer on flight pay and other forms of pay. It bumps up pretty quick. You also get a housing allowance. They call it BAH, and that's tax free. So there's some tax free pay that comes in. So, I mean, I try to tell young Marines this all the time. Like, yeah, your numbers may not look that great compared to what you think you can make on the outside, but you also got to factor in like 25% of your pay is not taxed. So, you know, you got to think about that, bro.
Yeah. So you were able to save and invest quite a bit of money.
Yeah. My investment, this could be a whole other podcast, man. I've had some interesting wins and some really, really painful, painful losses. In 2008, I met a guy. He actually deployed with me. So this was in Iraq. He used to be a trader at Morgan Stanley, and he was there when the towers fell, and he committed to serving in the Marine Corps after that. So his call sign was Voltron, and he was a genius in the market. Like, he just knew things. And in 2008, he was telling us, he's like, hey, the market is about to go through the biggest correction since the Great Depression. And if you put your money anywhere, you want a short real estate. And so he gave us an inverse ETF called SRS. And he's like, just ride this out. Just ride this out. And I thought he was crazy. I was like, come on. What does this guy know? But he was right. So made a little bit of money on that. A lot of guys did pretty well in that market. I mean, that was the first time I ever realized that you could bet against the market and actually make money when the market's going down. So that was an education. But I got greedy after that, Brad. I got greedy and thought that I knew shit that I didn't know. Before you know it, I was like short in bonds, thinking the bond market was going to correct, and, you know, ate my lunch there. A few years ago, when, I don't know if you remember when oil futures went negative. This was like in 2020-ish, I think. Actually, oil futures went negative. It was like wild. And I was talking to a buddy, and I'm like, he and I were strategizing, and I can't remember which direction we went. We might have went long on oil, and then it kept getting buried, and I just lost it. I was correct over the horizon, but just because of the timing that I did that very aggressive trade, didn't work out for me. So I've since learned that my investment strategy is just think long term, pick some winners, and just ride it out.
So when you do these sorts of things, are you talking about a quarter of your net worth that you're taking and taking this big risk with?
I don't even remember. I think I've really tried to block out that oil trade because I think I lost a shitload of money on that one. I probably shouldn't say because my wife would hear it and she would get pretty upset with me.
All right, moving on. Voltron is a hell of a call sign. What was yours?
Yeah, mine was Lapdog.
Lapdog. I like that one too.
Lapdog.
Probably Maverick and Ice are already taken, right? Iceman.
The thing is, like, especially in the Marine Corps, especially in my squadron, you don't get generally cool call signs. You get really, really highly offensive call signs that you can never tell your wife about. Mine wasn't really that way, but there's plenty of guys where the stories are horrendously embarrassing.
And so when you introduce yourself to each other, do you have to say what that embarrassing call sign is? Like, hi, I'm Fuckface.
Usually comes up, you got to warm up a little bit, and then the stories come out, and then you're like, oh yeah, that's pretty bad.
So I know you to be a deep thinker. Can you tell me about all the time you served and what the transition, like the veteran transition, tells us about humanity?
Yeah, you were getting into it when you mentioned that story about your friend that you ran into and going in for the hug and kind of felt cold. That really made me think about this, because an area that I'm really getting a lot of passion in, because I have witnessed, and it's not just like one or two friends. I mean, I've witnessed probably at this point dozens of friends who have struggled with whatever the issue is. If you want to call it PTSD, depression, anxiety, whatever it is, they're carrying that baggage from their service and they've done everything that was ever asked of them. They took all the SSRIs, they did all the talk therapy, years of working with it, and nothing would work. And then they do something highly unconventional that you would never think a in the box kind of veteran military guy would do. And that's go do psychedelics. And I have seen, again, dozens of my friends try everything and basically get nothing. And then after one weekend, come back completely changed. I mean, 180 degrees difference. And so, yeah, being the deep thinker that I am, I'm like, there's got to be something with this. What is this? And so in my personal time, I actually read the research. I look into the neuroscience. I interview and talk to a lot of people to try to understand it. As a side thing, like, it's actually a dissertation that I'm going to work on. I'm in a PhD program. I know that sounds super nerdy, but like, I'm going to bring psychedelics into this PhD conversation and dissertation. And I've already pitched it to the faculty and they love it and we'll see where it goes. But it's become, I would say, my passion. And as a side note, like, I don't know if you've fallen in like all the stuff that's happening in Texas with the Ibogaine Project and Rick Perry. And I mean, what's wild is Rick Perry, a fighting Texas Aggie, one of the most conservative right-wing dudes you could find, is out there stumping for psychedelics, specifically Ibogaine, so much so that he just started Americans for Ibogaine. And he said that he's giving the rest of his life to this mission. That's Rick Perry. And so, you know, I'm very familiar with the research. So all of the research converges on this idea. Then you take in all this anecdotal evidence from friends and you just walk away with knowing this is the way. Like, this is the way that we can help people heal and move on. Now, the conversation about what drives us to that, I'm not so sure it's always combat. I will tell you, Brad, that in my interviews with dozens of veterans who have gone through this experience, they walk away with, I would say probably 90% of them say when they have these experiences that they thought about something that happened to them in childhood. It wasn't even a military thing. It was a childhood thing. And so I've got this like working theory that what's different about this generation of military compared to, say, World War II is many of us that serve in the military have some kind of, I would say, broken home situation, but divorced family or father left when they were young. I have daddy issues. I'll say that. It's funny as it is. Like, I have dad issues. I had a challenging relationship with my father. And I can understand where guys are coming from when they say, hey, this is what I actually worked on. It wasn't even the shit that happened in Afghanistan. What I worked on was something that happened with me and my dad when I was 6. And so I think guys are coming into the military with a little bit of that foundational, call it trauma or whatever. They come with that background. And then that might be a reason why they serve, because they want to prove something to an authority figure. And then they have these experiences. Maybe some of them aren't so good and they walk away from the military even more damaged. And then that's really the trauma. I would say the second piece of that is, and this is actually it's funny, two stories together. I was in a bar in Brisbane just recently. Random thing, Brad. I meet this like little guy, redheaded guy. He's about my age and we're just talking, and he's Australian. And he's, you know, vibrant, you know, happy like all Aussies are. And come to find out, he's a SAS operator. So, you know, special forces in Australia. And we've supported the same missions in Afghanistan in 2012. Like, here we are meeting together in a random bar in Brisbane and we were supporting the same missions. And so I started talking to him like I do. Anytime I get a chance to talk to anybody that served, I get to this point. I'm like, so what do you miss? Like, do you miss anything? And he looked at me and he said, I miss being good at something. I miss being the best at something. And that resonates with me, because when I look back, I can think of like a couple missions where at that point in my career, I was the best in the world at what I was doing. And when you can be the best at something and actually look back and say, no one could have done that better. That feeling is so remarkable. And then one day it's all gone. And then now you're just like every other dude trying to like land a contract and pay your bills and work for the boss and all that. And I think that's where guys are struggling, is they go from being elite to not being elite. And they maybe have some past trauma that may have been exacerbated by their service. And now they're dealing with that. And then the whole VA system has no idea how to really help them, because they only know the SSRIs. They only know talk therapy. And this wild idea about going to Mexico and doing psychedelics is just so out there that people don't want to talk about it. And yet the data is there. The anecdotal stories are there. And now we're having this conversation, and I'm all about it, because I mean, I'll be an evangelist for this movement. I've seen my friends change. I know guys who were suicidal, who walked away completely changed men. And it's like, we have to move forward on this.
Yeah, I'm getting verklempt, because as you know, I relate to your story. And we're going to talk about this when we do another episode in October. So I'll make it light. You want to know my theory about Rick Perry? I think, I don't want to get sued. When he was in the primary debate and he had to list off three things that he advocated for and he forgot the third one. I've taken opiate medication, and what happens is you forget the third one. Mm. And so I tend to believe that he used Ibogaine to get off of opiates.
Mm.
Pure speculation. I don't know for a fact, but that I don't know that you could be such a strong proponent for Ibogaine unless you had done it. And, or of course, unless you've seen 90% of the guys you know that have gone that route get recovered from PTSD. But I've seen guys get off opiates, and it's given people their life back. And I'm so glad to see the Texas Ibogaine Initiative. In fact, I've tried to contact Rick Perry to be an evangelist, because I know the shit works. Yeah, it's unbelievable. But let's save that for the next episode, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love that.
I love Brisbane, by the way. If I had to live, it's probably top three places in the world. I thought it was that great.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. It's a beautiful place, very clean, still has all the nice things. And, you know, you can still get out in nature. The only problem is that the nature in Australia can kill you. So you got to be a little careful.
Yeah, that's true. You know, one time my wife and I were traveling down the Gold Coast, and we stopped to see some kangaroos on the beach, and there were like 25 of them. And I just went and like tried to shake their hand like a dummy. I didn't know they could beat your ass. So that was dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. You ever seen that video? I always thought this video was fake, but it must be real, because I've heard people talk about it. You ever seen that video of the guy? He walks out and the kangaroo's got his dog, and got his dog in like a headlock.
Headlock.
The guy runs out there and he just like squares up and starts boxing the kangaroo. I used to think that had to be AI, but this was like 10 years ago. So
yeah,
it must be real.
It's got to be real. They'll do that. And what if they gang up on you? You're screwed.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a source of nightmares right there.
You know, I'm gonna have to come up with a title for this episode, so I might just call it Fighting Kangaroos.
Let's do it. Fighting Kangaroos.
All right, you want to do fun questions?
Man, this part has made me nervous for a long time, because I've heard some of these questions and I'm like, I don't know if I can even answer half of these things. So begrudgingly, I will participate.
All right. Well, I get asked all the time, what is my favorite place in the world? And I know you're well traveled. I usually say, if I had to live someplace for 30 days, it'd be Thailand, Bali, or New Zealand, maybe. Give me a top three or top two.
Yeah, this is a layup, man. Thanks for starting off with the easy stuff.
I try.
Best place, hands down, and it's a clear number one, would be just about anywhere in New Zealand. I think New Zealand.
South Island? Outstanding.
I mean, if I was a young single man, South Island would be my place. I think as a family guy, probably North Island. It's hard, because I lived in Montana. I love Montana. I'm a mountain guy through and through. But in the South Island is that. Like, I love that nature scene. But yeah, I mean, New Zealand's definitely number one for sure. Number two, toss up. Can I do a toss up?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Chiang Mai or Thailand in general. I love Thailand. Thailand's great. I love the people there. The people are just so friendly. They're just so happy. I mean, I've never, I actually, one time, Brad, I had paid a tuk-tuk driver. I didn't do the Thai baht conversion right. And I meant to pay him like 10 bucks and I paid him like 150. He came back and found me and gave me back my money.
Wow.
I mean, I was shocked by that, but yeah, Thailand would be close. The second one, I like Greece.
I haven't been.
I love Greece.
Did you go to the Thai islands too?
Went to Phi Phi.
I love Phi Phi.
Yeah. Surprised you didn't have a joke there. I was waiting for a zinger. I was waiting for
you
one.
You know, I thought about that before we started recording. I'm like, Justin seems like a serious guy. Should I not, you know, being former military and as good looking, clean shaven you are with the beautiful teeth and everything. I'm like, I should keep the jokes aside.
No, man, I probably should have brought some of them too, but maybe I held them back. Maybe next time.
Oh, we have more fun questions. But this one's more serious, and I've asked it of just about everybody. Is not wanting something just as good as having it?
Not to get like cerebral on this question, but it's the chase that we like. It's when you actually get something that you want, sometimes that excitement goes away. It's almost as though the chase is really what we enjoy. And I think that's backed up by like the dopamine and, you know, all the way the brain works. But I mean, I would have to say yes in a way.
That's contrary to your monologue there, but yeah.
Well, okay, maybe I didn't understand the question. Phrase it to me again.
It's not
I don't do well with negatives. So like it has to make me think.
So I said is not wanting something just as good as having it, and then you talked about the chase and how enjoyable it
was. I got you. Yeah, I punted that one, man. I should listen better. Not wanting something. I'm trying to think if there's things that I don't want. And yeah, you stumped me on this one.
If you could switch lives with somebody just for a day, say tomorrow, just to experience what their life is like, who would it be?
Has anybody said Brad D'Antonio yet?
No.
Hey, I think that would be interesting. You got this nice little setup. I heard, you know, you work Tuesday through Thursday. Those are your work days, right? Yes. So you book in the 4-day work week. You got great people that you coach. I love coaching. I love coaching great people. So that's great. And man, I mean, look, you went out there and you busted your ass for a long time to get where you're at. And now you've cultivated this lifestyle where you can take your family and live in all these random places in the world. And you're right. Like the way that your podcast opens up with the little intro, it's like, would I rather be a billionaire or time rich? And the answer to me is I would rather be time rich because money is just it's a tool. But so many people who have so much money are not happy because they're so sucked up in all the bullshit that comes with that. And I have a friend who works so hard. He's actually a guy that I started a cyber company with. And I'm like, he works so hard. And I just always look at him. I'm like, dude, what is enough? Like, how much of an egg do you need on this? Like, what do you need? So yeah, I'm going to say if I could be anybody for a day, I would want to see what it's like to be Brad D'Antonio.
Thank you for saying that because it's nice to hear it from somebody because when you're living your life, you don't realize how unique it is, right? You just get immersed in what you're doing. And I never think about how other people perceive me, like almost never. And so to hear you say that, it just kind of reinforces what I've chosen to do with my life. So thank you. What's the most memorable negotiation you've ever had? What was your biggest takeaway?
Oh, negotiation.
Doesn't have to be money.
No, I would say, I mean, I've actually done this a couple times. So when I lived in Montana, I caught a really, really hot real estate market. The first house I bought out there was 429, I think. And then I think we sold it later for, you know, some amount, but then the people that we sold it to sold it for 880 or something within a span of a few years. Like, it just, the real estate market in Bozeman was ridiculous. But I remember in another house that I had purchased and sold, I could have gone with the better deal. Like, no kidding, like, walked away with more money in my pocket. But it truly was like that letter that comes in and you hear somebody's story. I hope it wasn't bullshit, but that made a difference to me to walk away from a deal making less money, but knowing that I just gave somebody a facilitated them walking into a dream home and a dream situation with a young family. Like, that was better than doing the deal with the real estate investor who's going to offer me the most cash that I can walk away with. So maybe not much of a negotiation, but I don't know, Brad, like, maybe I'm not a great negotiator because I usually just try to think about like a lot of other factors in the deal, especially when I'm dealing with, especially if I know that I'm dealing with pretty decent humans on the other end of it.
I love that. If you could turn any activity into an international thing that you think you'd be competitive in, what would that be?
Man, I've heard so many people struggle with this one. I should have like thought about, you know what I should have done is I should have gone to ChatGPT, typed in all these questions and prepared these responses, because this one I'm going to probably lay flat too. Man.
Well, I think I got the question from ChatGPT, to be fair.
So it probably knows the answer. Man, I do not know. I do not know. But can I answer it differently?
Please.
I don't understand why there are some sports that are in the Olympics.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's kind of where the question derives from, is that there's so many. There's break dancing. Like, maybe it could be anything. One guy said, I drink water really fast. That's interesting. So what are you good at?
Man, you're going to stump me on this one. I'll say this. I don't think curling should be an Olympic sport. That seems to be more like a game that people play. I mean, if we have that, we might as well have, you know,
Beer pong.
Yeah. Oh, beer pong would be great. You know, you remember Kyle Krusnick?
Of course. Yeah. I had lunch with him maybe three or 4 months ago. Yeah.
Bopper has I'm going to probably embarrass him if he listens to this, but Bopper's the only guy that I've ever known that tore his ACL in a beer pong game.
I didn't know that.
So there you go. I mean, yeah, maybe beer pong could be an Olympic sport because people get injured in it.
That's true. What do you think America's biggest geopolitical risk is, or maybe economic uncertainty, that's something we should be scared of?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the biggest one is our population demographics, the inverted pyramid that we have. And that one is a thorny topic, because the only way to really correct that inverted pyramid is to immigrate more people. If you really believe that you need to fatten out the bottom, because our birth rate is like, I think it's like 1.5 or 1.6. So we're not even meeting the replacement rate. So there will be less and less Americans every year unless something changes. And I mean, that's something that's facing a lot of countries, but then there's also some countries that aren't facing it. More of the traditional Islamic societies, their birth rates are very high. You know, there's other places that aren't experiencing the same thing. But for us, that's a massive risk. I mean, for sure. And I mean, that gets into like, what's the most appropriate way to bring people into the country? Or can you solve it through AI and robotics and other things?
Well, I think what you said about Afghanistan hits on it. It may take two generations to change our culture to where men aren't emasculated, women become more feminine. I see that here in Krakow, and it's so wonderful to see. You see these masculine dudes with very feminine women, and you don't see the polarity in America. So I think that needs to change. It's countries like Niger that have, what, 6 kids per woman, or Somalia. That's not good, because where you are in Japan, it's probably worse than us, worse than 1.6. South Korea's really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be immigration, but I think we've got to vet people and make sure we're bringing in the right people.
Yep.
If Obama is found guilty of orchestrating a years-long coup, as he's being accused of, what should his punishment be?
Oh, man. Oh, this was not... Have you asked anybody this one?
Yes, once.
Damn it.
You missed that episode.
Damn it. I did miss that episode. I think a great, great appropriate punishment would be to have all of Donald Trump's greatest hits, like all of his isms, and have that played on repeat in a prison cell for weeks on end. and just have that be like just on loop.
That's your best answer so far.
There we go. See, I just needed to warm up a little bit.
So if Donald Trump, speaking of Trump, asked you for your best advice, what would you tell him?
For him personally or for the country?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I think the first thing I would tell him, as if I was coaching him at all, is, and you say this a lot, like he's the thing about Donald Trump is he is, and this will drive liberals crazy. He, in my view, is right on so many things. He's right on so many things. How he delivers it and some of his tact could use polish. I know that's part of his strategy and that's part of his shtick. And that's just kind of, he riles people up and maybe that's part of his negotiation strategy, but really good leaders have a way of garnering support from both sides. Now, I think the reality is like the far left is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. And I think we've seen that. So there's more of this middle base that is tired of the way things used to be. But my first thing to him would be, man, you are so right on so much. If you could just tighten up a few things every once in a while, that would be really, really nice. Yeah.
Maybe the military would have helped with that.
Like him serving the military?
Yeah. For polish.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, you look a lot more polished than I do right now.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think what's been a breath of fresh air is there have been things that have been said and conversations that have occurred that would have never happened in other administrations. That is true. I just hope that we can continue to see it through. I think for the country, I think the biggest problem that we face is our financial situation. We can't keep driving ourselves in debt. Like that's actually another thing that scares me is when or if the day comes when we lose our reserve currency status or we can't keep funding this machine that's pretty artificial. I mean, we saw all the inflation that happened these last few years. I mean, there's some crazy number out there that like 80% of all the dollars in circulation were printed from like 2021 to 2023. I mean, that's going to have an effect, but we just keep hitting that credit card and here we are.
All right, let's do some fun money questions. These questions are money. If I gave you $100,000 and told you you had to invest it in one tech stock, where are you putting the money?
Tech, I would say, not because you talk about it, but I agree, Tesla. Yeah, I think people don't understand that Tesla is not a car company. It's far more than that. Car is just proof of concept. Like that's like stage one. There's a lot more coming from Tesla.
Are you invested?
Yeah.
Ditto. Cool. If I handed you $1 million tomorrow, what would you do with the money? Or if somebody handed you $1 million tomorrow, what would you do with the money?
Yeah. So when I go back home, I don't have a place yet to live. So with that money, I would buy a house.
And with cash?
With cash. Yeah. I mean, I don't like the interest rates, obviously, right now. I think it's obviously a very brutal market. I think a cash buyer can come in and probably move a price or two. And I just like the idea, very similar to like the life that you've built. I just want to be able to not worry about what I make and what bills I have to pay. And I've told my wife this, the very moment we have money like that, I have equity in a cyber company that I started and we think we're going to sell it this fall and that should be great. That's what I'm going to do because I want that freedom of just walking away saying we've got a place to live and we don't have to worry about this anymore.
I like that. Speaking of wives, what's the best quality a wife can have?
I would say genuinely, because this has been true for me, is someone that really believes in you.
So supportive. Really,
yeah, really believes in what you're doing.
There was a song back in, I think it was 2014, that said, "Ooh, I found myself a cheerleader." And I thought, yeah, every man wants a cheerleader, right? Not maybe literally. She didn't have to be on the squad, but hey, root for me, boo.
Yeah.
Cool. Have you ever had a favorite baseball card that you've owned?
Man, baseball card. Oh, I used to, I had all of those baseball cards, man. I can't remember. It would be hard for me to remember one in particular.
Okay. Who was your favorite player in the early 90s? Oh, you had one? You thought of one?
No, I can't think of a baseball card right now. Although, you know, it's funny. I used to always love like anything Jose Canseco, just because of how yoked he was. He was yoked. My favorite baseball player. Hard to pick. I'll tell you, there's something about watching Ken Griffey swing.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Being an Astros fan and a Houston kid, though, like toss up between Biggio and Bagwell. Great watch. Although I actually like Brad Lidge before he gave up that 600-foot bomb to Pujols. Like, I love when Lidge would come in. Yeah, that ruined him for like 3 years.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Chase earlier. He tells a story when he must have been 25, 26, I don't know. And I don't know how he got to face Brad Lidge. Maybe he was in the minors for a week or something. And he said he had always seen him strike everybody out with that slider. And he was like, "I'm not going to swing at it." And sure enough, he struck out. And he's like, "It's that hard to beat. It's like Mariano Rivera's cutter. You know it's coming, but you just can't hit it."
Yeah, you know, if I can add one more, I think the guy that I might appreciate the most when I look back is Greg Maddux.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, nowadays every guy out there is throwing like 100, like everybody's got heat. Mm. Greg's out there throwing like high 80s and just like guys can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
I mean, just really fascinating to go back and watch him play.
He's a jokester too, and I hate that I talk. I worry that people think that I talk about Chase too much, but he has a story about Greg Maddux too, because Mike Maddux was coaching with him, and this wasn't, but maybe last year. And Greg Maddux came to visit, and he's a total prankster. Like, he leaves pubes on the soap and stuff to mess with people. And he's got some funny Greg Maddux stories.
Yeah.
What's the other guy you mentioned? Oh, Bagwell. So I was at La Peak one morning. This is like a Wednesday morning. I was in Houston. And he walked in, this is probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And he was with that woman that was married to that hand surgeon. Did you ever see that commercial with the hand surgeon and this wife of his? They had like 4 or 5 kids surrounding him. And one of the kids at the end of the commercial said, "Daddy's little girl," or something like that. And I thought, this is so phony. There's something going on with this family. And so this dude got indicted and went to jail. He died in jail. They divorced him. I guess she got a settlement or something. And then she married Bagwell. And when I saw them two at La Peep, this was on Westheimer, right near the Galleria, he looked so raggedy. Like, he looked like a drunk and his beard was all grown out. He looked nothing like the man he used to be. So, you know, that's my Bagwell story. Do you think he was on the roids?
He was. Oh, it's sad to say. I think everybody was at that time. You had to be. So many guys had to be.
Were you tempted as a baseball player?
I mean, I couldn't do it at the Naval Academy. No.
All right. If you were on Jeopardy and got to choose the final category, what would it be?
God, where do you come up with this stuff, man?
I don't know. I'm told that I'm weird, but I keep going.
Final category on Jeopardy.
Don't change.
Wow. I mean, do you see me? I'm sweating over here. This is how much stress I'm going in. I'm this is hard.
I'm trying to level the playing field because you can see us, and you're such a better looking dude than me. I gotta make you sweat,
man. All your other guests make this look easy. I'm really struggling in this one. I like history. Mm-hmm. I studied history in college, thinking I was going to be a professor teaching history, but that never panned out. But yeah, something on history. Although I'm Got to study back up. I've forgotten everything I once learned.
Which part of history do you like most?
I took a lot of Civil War classes, partly because I really liked one of the professors that taught them, but it's hard to replace or not really love World War II history, just because, I mean, that's like Pax Americana. Like that's when we came in and really established ourselves as like a force for good. So World War II history, definitely number one. Band of Brothers, that whole series, I'm trying to get my wife into. I'm telling her, like, you got to get through the first couple episodes. It's a little slow, but the rest of it is great. That was really well done. And, you know, having a grandfather that served in World War II, like, that's the peak right there.
Where did he serve? And did you get to hear his stories? I imagine he's not still with us.
No, he never talked about his stories. He was in the army. He came in on the back end of Normandy and he fought through, I think he got wounded in France. He has a Purple Heart, had shrapnel in his legs for, you know, the rest of his life from it. But yeah, those guys, and especially him, they'd never, ever talked about it.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about?
Man, no, I think this is... Well, look, how about this, Brad? Thank you very much for having me on. I mean, I remember when you started this project some years ago, and I remember maybe like giving it a glance and not really diving in. But since you and I reconnected recently, I've been, you know, just jamming through all the episodes again at 1.5 speed. So you talk a lot faster when that happens, but really, really impressed with what you're doing. And I love the guests that you bring on. I love your solo episodes, like really enjoy that. And, you know, just wanted to acknowledge again, the fact that you don't have to coach the guys that you do. You could just kind of ride off into the sunset and chill out and relax. But the fact that you're providing value to people and waking up and doing that and putting the effort in, I just want to acknowledge, like, I'm really, really impressed by that. And think it's just amazing that you're putting that out there for these guys.
Thank you, man. You're going to get me all crying and then you'll be sweating and I'll be crying. So that means a lot coming from a stud like you, man, because I've started digging into your stuff. And as I said, you're an excellent writer, but you're doing a podcast too. And you just had one with Chase Rowan. Am I saying his name correctly?
Yeah, Chase. Yeah, you're going to have to get him on.
I'd love to.
Yeah. Great story. A 17-year opioid addict who turned it around with Ibogaine. And I think you having him on your podcast would be, you could tell he's fired up about it. He's
a great advocate. As he should be. That's awesome. Yeah. So I would encourage you to keep going. You're just getting started, right?
Yeah. Just getting started. I mean, I looked at it, Brad, where I just kind of realized I have a lot of people in my life that are really cool and that I really love and just love to have conversations with. And I mean, in a way, it's a way for me to record and memorialize these conversations so that I can go back to them in the future. So I kind of look at it like if nobody listens to the podcast, it's no big deal because I'm just recording conversations with friends that I love.
There you go. Do it like dancing, like nobody's looking. And it might turn into something that people love. That happens. And that's awesome. Well, if we ever get a chance to hang out, you're not buying a beer or a meal. It's on me. Your money's no good with me, brother. Till the end. All right. I promise.
Well, I might take you up on that. Yes. Hopefully we'll see you in real life here one day. That'd be nice.
Yeah. So much respect for you and your service. And like I told you, you and Brett Johnson, I look at y'all as total studs in a way that I look at no other friends of mine. So.
Well, I appreciate
that. Really good to connect with you, man. Let's do it again in October.
Yeah, let's do it. I look forward to that conversation.
Cool. How can people connect with you?
I'm on all the socials, Facebook, Instagram. My Substack is through Feather and Fire. That's the little project that I just started working on. So you can find me there. I'm always posting about some big idea or something going on. So, I mean, I don't take quite the pictures that you do, like of my calves or anything, but you know, maybe one day I can get them out there.
My calves come up a lot. Calves overseas. I don't have to give them a name. But yeah, so thank you, dude. This is enjoyable. Yeah. We'll do it again. Through Feather and Fire. That's important to know because I've tried to listen on Spotify and I put Justin Jackson in there and it doesn't come up. So it's Through Feather and Fire, and through is spelled the real way, right? Not T-H-R-U. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you, buddy. Friends, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in. You know where to find me. And if I can do anything for you, please let me know. We'll chat back at you next time. God bless y'all. Bye.